got him. Fire in the hole. Boom! And he pounded this buck. I mean, could not have walked up there and put a better shot on him. And he had rubbed the top of his antlers and just stopped. Was like, oh, crap, I'm hungry. I need to eat. And then we didn't let him finish the process because we shot him. The only way I learn lessons is the hard way. And I always think back to a buck that I hunted in 2010 that I just kept blowing stalks on. Knowledge of an area is more important than the trophy quality of an area. Hey, I hunted my butt off for that thing, and it meant the world to me, and it still does, and I love that. This is Henry Ferguson, aka Big Chief Whack-a-Buck, or Not Fit to Hunt, and you are listening to The Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
There's a lot of people that can pull the trigger on an animal, but they don't know what to do with it after.
If you would have told me that a stupid turkey was going to make me get that excited, I'd have told you you were crazy.
It's just a skill that you have to perfect over a lot of years.
Hunting is a tribal activity. We've lost the tribe. We can't even hunt together anymore.
Well, the people that are anti-hunting are usually pro-abortion. So kill the people, save the animals.
I just remember riding my horse back to camp with the northern lights and the moose behind me, and I'm like, this is why I've done this. This is as cool as an experience as I will get.
Hi, this is Jim Shockey.
This is Sam Sohol, the public land bus guy.
Hi, I'm Kimmy Greentree.
Hi, this is South Cox with the Western Bowhunter Podcast.
Hey, this is Ben DeDamonte, a.k.a. Shed Crazy.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, y'all, today on the episode, I have the one and only Henry Ferguson. Y'all might better know him as Not Fit to Hunt, or the one and only Big Chief Whack-a-Buck. Henry, man, I'm glad we were just talking before this, and it's been Isaac Ailman introduced us, and it's been like 3 years or something since that introduction. I'm finally getting you on.
Yeah, kind of strange. You know, it's good being on, and always willing to sit down and take an hour or two to talk about hunting. The journey that it's been in my life, you know? So,
yeah, I figure anybody that Isaac introduces me to has to have some sort of strange thing going on in their head. So they've got to be interesting, right?
Well, I think kind of the measure of a man is the friends that he keeps. And, you know, Isaac has an interesting mix. Well, it says, you know, we have a good open mind and are willing to take it where it goes, man. I mean, that's just kind of life anymore, you know?
Oh yeah. No, I think I've told the story. I have had Isaac on. I told the story before about how him and I met, and it was like in a total archery challenge. And he was just like this random dude that was kind of interesting. And I talked to him for a while. And he's sitting there after the show. He's like trying to sell me on Easton arrows, like hardcore. He's like, dude, you got to be shooting Eastons and this and that. And I'm like, why is this guy so like all about the Eastons? Like, he's really trying to push this shit on me. Like, and then he's like, you don't know what I do? And I'm like, okay. Yeah, no, that makes a little more sense. But y'all can go back and listen to my episode with Isaac if you want. But
oh yeah, and the funny thing is, I mean, the first time I met Isaac at through Badlands PAX years ago, and I've always told Isaac, and we've since become really good friends. And in fact, he and Junior are coming over to hunt deer with me and my buddies this year. But I always tell Isaac that the first time I met him, it clearly meant a lot more to me to meet the great Isaac Aleman than it did for him to meet some clown named Henry Ferguson. And that's okay. I mean, hey, it's life's like that. You know, when you meet your heroes, sometimes they remember meeting you and other times they don't. And you know, that's all right.
Oh man, I love that. He's just it's hard to describe him. He's just such a unique person. And If you've met Isaac, you know exactly what we're talking about. If you haven't, I'm sorry, you're just gonna have to live with that for, you know, until it happens. So
go to a total archery challenge and there's a pretty good chance you can. Mm-hmm. But you won't find him at the Easton booth. You'll find him at the Black Rifle Coffee Company booth now.
There you go.
So that's the difference, but still the same guy.
Oh, absolutely. So
yeah.
You know, one thing I always like to ask folks is just, you know, a little introduction of kind of who you are, but especially from the perspective of like, how did you get introduced to hunting, the outdoors, and this whole thing where we love so much?
Well, that's a great question, because I mean, like most people, you know, we all have our own little individual journey of how we got to be in the outdoors. And I mean, truthfully, I was born to be in the outdoors. I just was. And it's something that I'm happiest when I'm there. I'm most fulfilled when I'm there. And, you know, I spend, as a kid growing up, I mean, I used to just beg my mom to take me to the lake, and I'd throw this little lure out there and fish. I could fish for hours every day. And that was my passion. You know, that was what I did. When I got a little older, I went on a hunt with my dad, and it just happened to be a mule deer hunt in Montana. And he took a little buck, and man, I'm telling you, I was done for then. I mean, that was one of the coolest days of my life. I mean, that was probably 40 years ago. And there are moments and little snippets of that I can remember like it was absolutely yesterday. And I knew, as growing up, I knew that those were the kind of memories I wanted to make with my son and with my wife and with my family when I got to be an old fart. And it's been, I mean, I can tell you right now, I mean, some of the stories, the hunt stories that I have with my wife and son are absolutely the best. I mean, I've been on some great hunts, killed a few great deer, but if you ask me my favorite hunt stories, it's almost always going to go back to one of the stories with them. And it's cool, because for me being a hunter, I know what to expect of myself when the chips are down, when the bull's coming in, or when I'm sneaking in on the buck and waiting for him to stand. I know what to expect, but I do not know that of my wife and son. That's a bit of a mystery to me. And I those moments just tend to be filled with so much excitement, because, you know, this last year we snuck in on a buck, my buddy Rivers, Koskinen, myself, and with my son, and it was my son's tag. He's 14 years old. We snuck in on this buck, and all of his does are up feeding, clear, visible as can be. I can see the top of his rack feeding in this draw. I can just see the top of his rack and barely the top of his back. But I'm kneeling, looking through my spotting scope. My son is literally laying down prone. So he's, you know, a foot and a half under me. So he can't see anything. He can see his antler tips come by every once in a while. And so the cool thing was, we sat there and watched this buck for like 10 minutes, feeding, waiting for him to come out. And finally, when he comes out, this stinking thing comes out and like is just angling, quartering away, going through this little hole in the brush. And Kyle goes, "I got him. Fire in the hole." Boom. And I mean, just that fast. And he's pounded this buck. I mean, could not have walked up there and put a better shot on him. Nice. And, you know, I mean, moments like that, it's just cool, you know? And I mean, it's where you see all of that hard work that you've put in at the range with them. You just see it come through, and you see it all pay off. And it's, if it gets cooler than that, I don't know how. It's just something I enjoy so much.
That's like, you tell that story and all of a sudden, like the second you're getting into that moment, like I'm getting pumped up. Like I was there watching it with you. And, you know, we're talking just before this about, like, you know, just telling those hunting stories and how that, like, you can gain so much out of just hearing.
Oh yeah.
Hearing those stories pass back and forth. It's huge.
Well, and it's cool, because that's our heritage. You know, I mean, that's our heritage as hunters, is those stories. And I mean, I love hearing them. I loved hearing them as a kid. I love hearing them now. And it's awesome to be able to hear somebody share their story of success. And, you know, there's always a little nugget. If you mine deep enough, there's always a little nugget you can get out of there that can help you be successful later on if you're paying attention and willing to learn, you know?
Oh, absolutely. So now you mentioned your wife hunts as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did she hunt before the two of you met or?
Nope, not at all. She was raised, it's all your fault. It is 100% my fault. Yeah. And you know what? Just couldn't be more pleased with that.
Nice.
She is, my wife is just this kind, loving person who turns into an absolute cold-blooded assassin when there's an animal in the crosshairs. It's just the weirdest thing. She just has this ability to keep her crap together, you know, and her thoughts straight. And in the moment of truth, if she's got crosshair steady on that animal, it better be practicing falling down, because it's about to happen. I mean, it's a cool thing.
I feel like when women get really invested into hunting, like women that everyone I've seen, like when they're really invested, they are like, before that shot, they're the steadiest, like most cold-blooded. They could be the most emotional person in every other aspect of their life. But when they're invested in that hunt, they're like, God help me if they were an assassin on my tail.
Well, and you know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And the funny thing is, it kind of leads to some of the lessons that you learn as a hunter. And some of the, I mean, for me as a mule deer hunter, I learned, I'm not a super patient person throughout my life. It's just not one of my gifts that I was given as a, you know, when we came to Earth. I want something to happen, and I want it to happen here pretty quick. Well, nothing teaches you patience like having your eye on one buck that you've been watching all summer, or maybe like the buck I killed this year, you've been watching since 2018. I've watched him for three summers. And the cool thing is I literally just got the email back from Robbie Denning a couple hours ago, told me that was a 6.5-year-old buck.
Ooh.
So pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I watched that buck for three summers. And this year he was the best buck I'd found. Each of the other years, I'm like, oh no, I'll find something better. He's just an okay buck. He's getting ready to just blow up in growth. And this year, I mean, we had a bad drought for one thing, but just having the patience to watch that buck. And then I watched him several times this year before I stalked him, because I knew I was probably only going to get one or two opportunities at this buck. He's an old deer, and you know, they just tend to be pretty impatient when it comes to people blowing stalks on them and bumping them out of their beds. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I, you know, just learning. And you know, the only way I learn lessons is the hard way. And I always think back to a buck that I hunted in 2010 that I just kept blowing stalks on, just thinking, it's a numbers game. I'll figure it out. And truly, I never did. I mean, somebody has killed that buck, scored 201 3/8. In case you're wondering. Yeah, and that's all right. I've hunted exactly this many 200-inch bucks since then. So, you know, that's a tough one. It's a bitter pill to swallow, but, you know, it's one of those lessons that you just have to learn or you're doomed to continue failing.
Well, man, you know, if it makes you feel any better, you can see you can see my biggest buck in this picture right here.
Oh, I see that whopper back there, man. That's when you shot in Arizona, right?
Yep. Shot that down in Arizona. My first tag filled, my first buck period, you know, first archery, you know, whole thing. And I've yet to fill a mule deer tag since. I finally filled my elk tag.
Happy
with that. Hoping to make it back down to Arizona in August and chase some muleys over the counter. Before coming back up for elk, but we'll see, man. I've always been an elk guy.
Yeah.
I've always been an elk guy, But mule deer, like, I don't think they'll ever overtake elk in my mind, but they've been growing on me, man.
I'll tell you what. Here's where the world shifted for me. So in 2004, it's 2003. I was actually pretty new bow hunter. I'd been shooting a bow for a long, long time, shot in tournaments and stuff for years, but just hadn't really gotten crazy about bow hunting. And, you know, even though I'd hunted a bunch as a kid, I'd still go outdoors and went fishing a lot and stuff, but just bow hunting hadn't really tipped me over the edge just yet. And so I was glassing this herd of elk, and I just knew this herd's pattern so well. And it was going to happen. I mean, it was just a matter of time. And I knew I was going to hunt these bulls like the middle of the month, and I was going to be ready. So one of my neighbors at the time, a guy named Fred, gave me some terrific advice. And he said, Henry, get out there and shoot a deer this weekend. I go, oh, yeah, it's just that easy. I'm just going to go shoot a deer this weekend. Great idea, Fred. Have you seen the statistics? Do you know how low the odds are of this happening, much less on command? I'm just going to go out and shoot a deer this weekend. So I went out that weekend, and it had just been pouring rain for days leading up to the beginning of the season. And as it was, I went down this big hike, made a big loop through this big basin, and saw a lot of sign and stuff, but never saw any animals. And I'm literally walking back on the road, and I'm like a mile and a half from my truck, and I cut this really fresh set of tracks walking on the road, on this old dirt road. I'm like, well, this is kind of cool. So I followed the tracks for a couple hundred yards, and they veered up into the woods, and I just kept following the tracks. And eventually I lost the tracks, and I'm sitting here looking around, and I'm like, man, which way did that deer go? I mean, I can't see the tracks anymore because I'm in thick grass. I look over, and out of the corner of my eye, I catch a tail flick. The deer is standing 45 yards away from me. So I drew back, and I couldn't have walked up and placed the arrow any more perfectly on this deer. And I shot, you know, I mean, it just went perfectly. And I shot this deer because he said, Fred told me, he goes, Henry, you don't want your first experience at full draw on an animal to be, you know, on a big game animal, because I'd shot a bunch of rabbits and stuff. Mm-hmm. He goes, you don't want it to be on a trophy animal. He goes, just get out there, get it figured out, and then you'll be more ready. So it was terrific advice. And had the elk ever freaking shown up, it would have, I mean, I think I would have been way more ready. But I hunted those stinking elk day after day. And that pattern that was just, I'd spent all that time working on developing, they just completely ghosted me. And so began my stories as an elk hunter, because they drive me nuts, man. They drive me absolutely crazy. But while I was hunting that big herd of elk with that huge bull in there, I managed to sneak in this oak brush. And there were a bachelor herd of bucks. There's a bachelor herd of bucks up there. And I got in close on this bachelor herd. And I found myself 5 days after I had shot that doe. So I'd already filled my deer tag, 10 yards away from two Pope and Young bucks. Sam, you talk about top pin close. I mean, it was crazy. It was like top pin, hold it a couple inches low, kind of close.
You've got to lean back so the broadhead doesn't brush it.
Oh, man. Yeah. It was pretty crazy. And that's, you know, that's that right. That day right there, I kind of became a mule deer hunter. I was like, man, this was cool. I want this experience again, but with a tag, you know, in my pocket. So, and I've just been chasing that high again ever since, man. I mean, that's, and I think that's really what it is. I mean, you know, 18 years later, I'm still just hoping for just one more chance at a big buck, you know?
That's awesome. I'm excited to finally start being able to hunt some places consistently, because everywhere I've hunted, I've never really got to either chase a deer or spend time scouting, getting to know an area and that. And I'm excited to be out here in Montana now to where I can really consistently hunt these same areas or scout them or, you know, get to know a few different areas and really start investing in maybe shooting a bigger mule deer, maybe shooting something with a fork this time.
It's going to pay off. I can tell you right now that will pay off, because knowledge of an area is more important than the trophy quality of an area. Mm-hmm. Because if you know what's there, you're going to be able to mine out those better, you know, the better bucks that live in the area, and you'll know where they're going. You'll figure out those patterns and figure out where they go once they get bumped by either you or other hunters or hikers, if you're in Colorado or, you know, I mean, it's that knowledge really pays off. I'm telling you.
Oh, without a doubt. Like everyone talks about that, like the benefits of hunting in an area consistently time and time again. And it's like, I knew that in my head, but I never really realized it until I was hunting here in Montana in 2019. And I had just quit my job. I'd started my business. And so I was out here for like 6 weeks hunting elk. And for the most part, I tried a few different places, but for the most part, I spent majority of my time chasing this herd or these couple of herds in this one section of public. And I learned that piece of public like the back of my hand. I mean, I knew every nook and cranny they could hide in there. I still didn't manage to get one, but I just started seeing the difference when you see that herd. You're like, you know exactly where you can cut through and how to get around them. Like if you're going this direction to not wind them or whatever that happens to be. And saw a few whitetail in there, saw a few mule deer. I had a doe, and I can't remember off the top of my head if it was a whitetail or a deer, but the funny thing about Montana is like the units are all so different for the general tags, to where it's like, okay, one unit, you're on your general tag, you're able to shoot mule deer bucks, elk bulls and cows, and whitetail does. The other one, you may only be able to shoot an elk bull, a mule deer buck, and a mule deer doe, and no whitetail. A different one, you may not be able to shoot mule deer at all, but it's like, it's so, and I just completely forgot which one I was in. So I'm sitting there staring at this, this doe. And I'm like, I hadn't seen any. I'm like, I would be very happy to take home that doe and put it in the freezer. Like that looks like a tasty ass hunk of meat.
There you go.
And I just sat there staring at it like an idiot. And I'm like, crap, what am I allowed to shoot in here? Which unit am I in again? Crap. And finally I ended up getting back to the truck and looking it up. I'm like, yeah, I could have shot that.
Oh,
that's awesome. But
you know, and I do like the way Montana manages like that though, because it allows them to really micromanage a herd. And I think that that's one of the problems that Colorado gets into, is we tend to like clump a bunch of units together for a tag. And I mean, some of them are really big geographically, and it just doesn't allow them to manage that as detailed and as fine as I think they should. But hey, my wildlife biology degree, I'm still waiting for that to come through. You know, mostly because I never went to school for it, but you know, that's my own opinion.
I went to the University of Instagram for wildlife biology. I'm
expecting. Yeah. I'm surprised we never saw each other in class.
Exactly. Well, when I call my advisor, I'll ask him where your paperwork's at.
Appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate that. That'd be real helpful.
But man, you know, looking at your Instagram, you may not have gotten that 200 plus. You may have not have
found yet. Not yet.
Not yet. Not yet. But there are definitely some beauties up on your wall here. And man, you just posted that non-typical that you just posted. Is it today or yesterday?
Yeah, that's a buck that lived actually pretty close to our house. And that one, we aren't sure if it was, we're pretty sure it was a mountain lion that got him. But he's no longer with us. Sad day. But his running mate was actually, he was another huge buck, and he wandered onto the wrong chunk of private property this last year and chasing does, got himself shot. So
isn't that always the way for a guy to get in trouble?
it's not a new story, that's for sure.
Oh man. So, I was just talking with a bunch of people about non-typicals recently, and like I can't ever decide what I like more. Like, you know, and it's, oh darn, I guess I have to pick. No, I don't. But it's just, it's like, you know, if you got those two, you know, you got those two mealies right next to each other, you got that perfect, like, basket, you know, just gorgeous, you know, 180 plus muley. And then you've got the other one that's just got weird drop tines, like hanging down over its face. It's all asymmetrical, looks like maybe the family tree hasn't branched all that much.
Yeah.
So which one are you going for? You got them both at, you know, 20-30 yards broadside. Which are you taking?
So for me, that it used to be a tough decision, and I used to think, man, give me that big typical. And I would still, I mean, I have, well, I was going to say an unspoken goal, but as soon as I say it, it's not unspoken anymore. I would love to shoot a 200 inch net typical. That's a goal of mine that I would love to do, but I want a big trashy buck for my wall. I want something with just, you know, giant frame with stickers everywhere, big bases, and, you know, I mean, that's what I'm looking for. But yeah, it's tough. And I mean, the fact is, I'll take the bit, whichever one I feel is biggest. That's how, there's my cop out answer for you.
Yeah. I don't know what I'd do in that case. I think for me, it would come down to, if I'm looking at both bucks, like which one just looks like the older kind of gnarlier deer, like, just, you know, maybe one's a little bit grayer in the face, or a little more stooped, or whatever it is. Whatever one just looks like he's been around longer, maybe a little bit smarter, a little bit tougher. I think that's what I'd go for. But honestly, at this point, I my goal is getting a forky. That's all I care about. As long as the next one I get has a fork.
There you go, man.
The sky's the limit there.
I'll tell you what. Let me tell you the easiest way to do that. That is, put your bugle in a box and leave it at your house and hunt deer. That's the easiest way to do it, is you just got to devote the time to it. But with you saying those two bucks standing side by side, I had a story back in, gosh, I think it was 2004. So it was the second year after I'd shot that doe, back out hunting with my wife, and we went into this spot where opening day we had seen a big bachelor herd, and it had like four standout bucks in it. I mean, four bucks that were like, oh, I want that one. Oh no, that one will do too. I mean, there were just four great bucks. And one of them was this big wide buck. He was like almost 30 inches wide, and he had these crabby fronts, but just these huge backs and a giant body. So as it turns out, 2 days later, we're back in that same spot, and we cut some fresh tracks. Follow these fresh tracks right after the rain. Anybody seeing a pattern or any sort of theme here yet? Hunting after the rains has been a real effective method for me. But we get in there, and I sneak down into this little draw, and I see them both bedded. And this is one of those humble pie moments here, so bear with me. I see them both bedded there, and they're like 55 yards. I'm like, done. Which one do I want? And I'm sitting here going back and forth. Got a little deeper forks on the younger buck, but man, that other buck's just so big. But I let those deep forks coax me in, and I so I drew back, and I'm like, man, I can't clear the brush to get this shot. So I knelt down, and I'm like, oh man, now I can't clear the brush closer to me. So I squatted down, and, you know, just a super solid position.
Oh, of course.
Took the shot, and naturally I dropped my bow arm, and I just dropped out of that shot. Went right under the deer. and I'm just sitting there kicking myself. And we walked, I walked down and grabbed that arrow, went back up to the trail. My wife standing there, just eyes just bugging out of her head. She goes, I go, did you see those deer? She goes, oh, yeah, they just ran past me like 25 yards. And she goes, they were, and I go, you didn't shoot? She goes, did you not hear me say ran past me at 25 yards? So we go around a couple more bends in the trail, and there they are, both of them standing there at 60 yards. Now, when they're standing up and you've got a giant bodied sway backed buck standing next to a young buck with good forks, but a smaller frame, then the decision was a little easier. I mean, that big one probably outweighed him by 50 pounds, but yeah, it was kind of funny. I mean, I made two different decisions because I got two opportunities at those bucks that day. And I made two very different decisions in the two encounters.
It's a benefit of having the full story, right? You know, you're
I didn't have all the information. Didn't have all the information the first time I saw them. So yeah, they were both bedded and looked the same. But
so now is your wife just as obsessed with the muleys as you are, or does she have her other stuff she likes to chase?
So my wife would rather hunt elk, which I just feel is a pretty significant character flaw, but I've got to overlook it.
The marriage can survive it, you know, with counseling.
It can. And honestly, it takes some discussion and some work, some compromise, but, and I don't know, she likes hunting elk because she has the biggest elk in the family. And
I just had this mental picture of, what is this? Is this a diaphragm call? Have you been
Exactly.
You just like get into bed and you pull back the pillow, the covers, and you find a diaphragm call.
What is this?
I've been on TikTok too much lately, so I need to know.
I'll tell you her elk story, okay? Her one elk story. It's very short. So she drew a rifle elk tag like 3 years ago out here, and it's in a unit that I know real, real well, scouted it a lot. And we've killed a couple bulls in this drainage where I thought we'd probably have the best chance at hers. So we went out and I'd scouted it a lot that year and knew that there was a lot of activity in this first drainage. And thought for sure, man, if we get in there early, we've got a decent chance of seeing an elk in there. And our trophy standards were spike or better because it was a bull tag.
Yeah.
And this particular unit, you can kill any antlered elk. So, I mean, literally, we're going out there to fill the freezer. So we get up there and first thing in the morning, and when I say first thing in the morning, I mean, like when we popped over the top, I looked at my watch and we were about 2 minutes away from legal shooting light. So I'm feeling pretty good. And like I said, we just popped over the top and I look out across this basin and it's more of a canyon than a basin. I'm like, holy crap, elk, elk, elk. So opening morning, first light, a couple minutes from legal shooting light. And I throw my binos up and I've just got eights and I'm looking, I'm like, it's a bull. My son, who, let's see, at the time he would have been like 10 or 11, pulls up his binoculars and he has tens and he goes, holy crap, it's a big bull. And so now our hunt has gone from, we'll take any spike that'll stand still, to we've got a big 6x6 standing out in front of us. And she gets down on the tripod because there was just enough ground cover. We couldn't get a decent shot prone. And so we get her on the tripod and holy crap, man, she is just, I mean, the wind's howling up there and she goes, it's just all over the place. So I reached over and turned the scope from 16 back down to 6 and she goes, oh, that's way better. And about 10 seconds later, dead ball. I mean, you know, it's just crazy. So literally the sun is not even up. We're, you know, by the time we got everything ready and got tripod out and stuff, we're like 10 minutes into legal shooting light. The bull was just feeding peacefully on the other side of the canyon, and he took one right high shoulder and boom, down he went. Done. Season was over. One bark of the rifle. So, jeez.
Well, shoot, man. But that's maybe kind I need of a to go. Theme maybe I need her. To go spike hunting then.
See, you just gotta adjust the expectations and be happy with what's out there, because we like elk burgers, and that's, you know, we were hunting for a full freezer, and as it turned out, it ended up with being a full freezer plus a $1,200 taxidermy bill.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I'll tell you what, since filling my first elk tag and then filling that freezer as well, and really, I mean, I think I've bought some chicken, and that's about as far as the meat I've bought in the past year, coming up on a year.
Yeah.
And I've gotten really used to that. And it's funny, you know, like everyone talks about, like, oh, you know, as the longer you hunt, the more you kill, you know, your standards go up and your requirements go up. And I'm kind of like, this year, I'm like, filling that freezer sounds like pretty damn good. My standards will start going up
priority. Once the
freezer is full. So I'm thinking, like, I need to go out before season and do like some doe hunts or some cow hunt or something somewhere.
If you can, absolutely. I do,
like, my good. Cause then I'm like, okay, got the freezer full. I'm not going to be sitting there questioning, like, if every time I pass a group of cows where that I'm like, oh, should I have just taken that?
Well, and I did something I've never done this year. I passed elk during archery season. I've never in my life passed elk. I don't do it. It's something that I'm like philosophically against. And this year I found a couple good bulls in my scouting, and I'm like, man, I'm just going to wait. I'm going to be patient. And I snuck in on three different herds and had multiple opportunities well within range. I had the lead cow sitting there scent checking me at like 18 yards this year. Jeez. On an either sex tag. But you know, there was a big bull in that herd, but he just never would. He was the weirdest thing. He just stayed in the middle of the herd, just stayed in the middle of cows. And I could have shot two of his satellite bulls and just waited for the chance on him, and which just never materialized. But
that's the,
so yeah, it's tough.
It's like, you know, you read all about elk hunting and it's like, okay, this is how you call them in and this and that. And, you know, I mean, and albeit I've not been elk hunting that long. I started in 2017. So, you know, I've been on total of four elk hunts, but I have never in my life had the experience of like, oh yeah, you know, you call the bull and it comes in and this and that. I'm like, I've barely seen some bulls.
It's tough,
you know. And it's like, you know, you watch too many, you know, you'll watch too many born and raised videos, you watch too much Randy Newberg, and you start thinking like every time you go, everywhere you go out, it's just going to be bugling and this and that.
Just
and
a matter, like, of time. Yeah.
And I know I'll get into it one of these days, especially, you know, the more I hunt, but it's just one of those funny things, you know. It's, I feel like that is the exception to the rule. Like calling in those bulls like that is the exception to the rule. And you got to get some serious time in the woods to really have that experience. But I'm excited for when I get it.
Oh, I completely agree. And honestly, those moments are, man, there's not much in the world like it. I mean, it's pretty awesome when you call in an elk. I mean, it's a pretty awesome feeling. And, you know, especially when they come in bugling and screaming. I mean, I called in my first bull that I ever shot, who's a 5x5. Which is a little smaller than my son's elk, which puts me third in our family of three for biggest elk. And that's okay.
Hey, you're still on the podium. You're still on the podium.
That's right. For now. They both have rifle tags this year. I better get my crap together.
Oh, no.
But, yeah. But truthfully, I mean, I spotted that bull way on the other side of a huge basin, And I mean, it was late in the evening, and I knew there was no chance I could get to him in time. So I literally, I blew on my little Primos power bugle, and I started with a couple cow calls, and he's looking around. I'm like, how can he even hear me that far away? But you know, just a big open bass, and they can, the sound carries well. And I thought, you know what? I got that new bugle and I don't totally suck with it. I'm going to give it a shot. So I blew on the bugle, and he looks over and is like watching really intently. And then I cow called again, and that bull started kind of trotting down the hill. And I'm like, that's pretty cool. I mean, still thinking he's got a long ways to go. He's like 800 yards away, you know? And so I'm just watching. I'm like, I'm not really going to get excited. I'm not going to get my decoy out or anything until he covers that, until he crosses this hill in between us. And holy crap, he's on my side of that and running. And all of a sudden things are going crazy. So, I mean, when he disappeared into some trees, I'm like frantically grabbing my decoy, threw it against a tree and ran like 20 yards in front of it and called him in. And that stinking bull walked right in and just took it. I mean, it was just like what you see on the videos. And it's something that, I mean, I haven't experienced a whole lot of time since, but I sure did enjoy it. And I'd love to have that again, but I'm not a great elk hunter, and I'm not a great elk caller by any means. And so I'd kind of stick with my strengths, and that's spot and stock.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, I think that's why I'm so drawn to elk, is like that experience. It's like, I really do love hunting mule deer. I mean, I just love hunting in general. You put me on just about anything.
Yeah.
I was even telling someone, I'm like, I don't care what it is. Put me in a high fence ranch in Texas, I'll still find a way to have fun. But
if you're not, you shouldn't be there. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, like that experience with the elk, I think is why that'll always be what hooks me, is just because they're such a weird animal. But you know, with those mule deer, man, the one thing I do like about mule deer over elk is I feel like when you see a big mule deer, the instant you see a big mule deer, oh, you know, that's a big mule deer. Like with elk, unless it's like just the biggest one you've ever seen, like you kind of attend, like you see them all in a bachelor herd, whatever, you know, you can pick out the biggest one usually, but there's a lot more like, how big is that one? You know, if you're looking at the size, but you see a big muley come out, like you're like, holy shit. Like that's,
yeah. Oh, it makes my heart skip a beat, man. I mean, it's probably bad for me physically, because and that's what I love about that scouting season, you know, that's coming up on us now, is when you find that buck and maybe you're looking in a new spot, or, you know, or looking in an old place where you haven't seen a good deer in a few years, and all of a sudden that buck is in your 15s or in your spotting scope. And it's, I mean, it's awesome. That is because the whole process starts there. I mean, I've had it start in, you know, it starts in July usually for me, because that's what, everything looks big in June, you know. But when they start forking and you see where they're, you know, how wide they are, how heavy they are and stuff like that, I mean, that's when the hunt really starts for me.
So are you definitely a hard horn guy over velvet?
Oh no, I've shot a couple real good velvet bucks, and I've shot a couple hard horn, but I mean, for the most part, our season, I mean, I'm finding that our bucks are holding on to velvet a little longer here, mm-hmm. Over the last few years. And I have absolutely no idea why that is. I mean, the buck I shot last year, I shot him on like September 19th in full velvet. Huh. And it just made no sense at all, but kind of strange. I mean, like I said, I'd watched that buck for 3 years and I'd never seen him hard horned ever. He'd always been in velvet, even late in the season. So it's kind of strange, but,
almost makes you wonder if it was like a genetic thing to where it like,
could be.
It just doesn't rub its velvet or something like that. That'd be interesting.
Oh, yeah. Well, he did rub his velvet, 'cause I've got a buddy who found one of his sheds, but, But yeah, I think they're just, there's a, you'll just find some bucks every once in a while that just hold on to it a little later. I mean, I saw a buck by my house like 2 or 3 years ago on October 23rd that was rubbing his velvet that day. I literally watched the buck rubbing his velvet. I'm like, what the heck? Because generally they're all stripped by like the 10th to 15th of September in our area.
Does Colorado, I forget, does Colorado have like an early season for bucks at all? Like a, like while they're in velvet, like pre-rut kind of a deal? Or?
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. So our, I mean, our archery season runs September 2nd through 30th. But there's also a few, and these are pretty hard tags to draw. There's some high country rifle tags that you can get as well, but you better have a whole pocket full of preference points to grab those. But they're early this year too. And they're like, I think they start like the 5th or 6th, something like that. I mean, it's really early this year.
So you can definitely kind of catch, I mean, in normal circumstances where they're not wait until October to rub them off, but you can catch kind of that tail end of the velvet season then.
Oh yeah.
In those first week, few weeks of September.
Definitely. Definitely. Like I said, ours usually don't rub, and they're usually, they'll start like around the, it's kind of that 7th to 15th range that you'll see some of the early ones going around the 7th. And then by the 15th, usually they're all hard horned by then.
It's such a weird, like deer and elk and it's such a weird thing, man. Like that whole process of dropping the antlers, regrowing them, and then the velvet and rubbing them off. And it's like, it's a nasty looking thing. I mean, when you find those rub offs, or you just see that big old buck or something with like bloody, it looks like just
blood red antlers.
It looks like some straight out of a horror movie that massacred some poor hiker or something.
Yeah, it looks like it just came out of a Stephen King audition, but it's cool though. And I almost shot a buck, and I still remember this years ago. This buck had just stripped his velvet. He was just a monster. And I snuck in on him and ended up having a little forky blow my stock, but I just kept thinking, oh my gosh, please let me kill this buck right now. This will be the coolest mount ever. He had it like hanging off his rack, you know, hanging down like off the bases of his antlers, but his rack was blood red. Oh, it was just, nice. It was the coolest thing. But yeah, unfortunately that forky had other plans.
I mean, that's definitely got to be like, I'm so big on getting them. If I'm going to get some mounted, I want it to have the feel that it did when I shot it. Like, so if I saw some like that with those red horns, I would be getting that to the taxidermist like that day. Like, I would be driving through the night to get that to the tax.
Yeah.
Be like, all right, you need to lacquer the shit out of these horns, or do what you gotta do, and then formaldehyde this bitch up.
So yeah, and I've shot a couple of them. I shot one that was like partially stripped, and he was able to save that was really cool. So like the top is polished and all tipped out, but the bases still have velvet on it. And then I shot another one couple of years ago with my son, that he had rubbed the top of his antlers that morning and just stopped. It was like, oh, he's rubbing his antlers like, oh crap, I'm hungry, I need to eat. And literally fed all morning. We watched this buck feed all morning and bedded down in brush where he could have been rubbing his antlers finishing the job, but it was like he just forgot. And so we snuck in and we didn't let him finish the process because we shot him. But that's one of the coolest mounts I have on my wall, because it's literally about the top 8-10 inches are stripped off, and the rest of it is just velvet just hanging off in strips.
Almost really reminds me of like, you know, you're hiking, whatever, you see the cattails where like just the top half has gotten knocked off. Yep. Kind of reminds me of like a cattail almost.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, funny, man.
Yeah. And I just feel like those two deer, like those two bucks that I killed, I mean, those are such a, if you think of how short the amount of time is throughout the year that that buck would look like that. I mean, it's probably measured in, you know, hours, not days for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, to be able to get them right then, I mean, it's just, it was really cool experience. But, and it's, it makes for a unique mount too, that not everybody has something like that.
I think that's what the magic is behind some of the non-typicals too, is a similar idea that, like, you know, okay, you shoot like this pristine, perfect basket, you know, basket antlered buck, you know, except for the 200. just had to rub that in a little bit there.
Yep.
But, you know, to some extent, they're all the same. They're all going to be unique and have different number of points and this and that, and, you know, different width, and some will be tall, some will be wide. But after a while, well, you've seen one perfect basket head, you've seen them all. But those non-typicals, every one is its own. It's one of a kind. Like, you see that non-typical, there's nothing out there.
Yeah.
Look like that thing. And you're going to be the only one that has one that looks like that. And there's a little bit of like, kind of a little ego and like, kind of like, that's pretty badass involved in that.
Yeah. And like I said, I've been looking for years trying to find one, you know, just trying to find a big non-typical that I could hunt. And, you know, it seems like every time I freaking find one, it's in a spot I can't hunt, a unit I can't hunt, or whatever, you know. And it's, I still love looking at them. I don't care if I can hunt them or not. I still love seeing big mule deer. I mean, you know, it's just such a, knowing how perfect the conditions have to be for an animal to grow, you know, have the genetics and have the feed and the water needed to grow that huge rack. It's just so unique. And that's why I love them, man. I just love finding big deer. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't care if they're non-typicals or typicals. I mean, I just like big deer. Having said that, I sure hope this is the year that I get to break 200 with something that just smashes it, you know.
Heck yeah. But
time will tell.
Well, that's one thing, you know, I got into it with some guys, and like, and again, I'm just going to clarify up front, like, as long as it's legal and ethical, I don't care how you hunt, where, you know, if you go to Texas and you pay to hunt like a high fence deer, all that stuff, cool. If that's what you choose to do, what floats your boat, that's awesome. I'm also like, don't pretend like it isn't what it is. Like, when I've gone to hunt Texas, I'm sitting there, I'm posting like, heck yeah, dude, I woke up in a nice comfy bed and I got a breakfast and some coffee and drank my coffee while the side-by-side took us to the blind. And I sat in that feeder and we sat and shot the shit until the feeder went off. And we waited for a couple of minutes until those fallow deer came over the ridge and blammo, we shot two of them. And then we threw them in the side-by-side back and we're back in time for lunch and a nap.
There you go.
But I was getting into it with some guys about like pen-raised deer. And those big old, we've all seen them. They'll happen. Yes. And yes, I understand somebody will write me and be like, oh, well, those happen naturally too. I'm like, yes,
they do. There's
like one in a million
or one in 5 million. That, yeah.
That gets that giant like bramble bush head.
Yeah.
That is just so ridiculously enormous. But I don't know where the pride is in shooting something like that, you know. In you didn't defeat it by any chance. It's practically somebody's backyard pet half of the time, and it hasn't lived that life. It's not giant because it like had those perfect genetics and it had all that, you know, natural feed, and it's smart and it learned and it, you know, kept away from other hunters and stuff like that. It's you didn't defeat anything, and that's what bugs me about it. I was trying to get that across, and the response is always, you're just jealous because you can't afford it.
Well, and hey, don't get me wrong, I see, you know, we're all into hunting for different reasons, and it means different things to each of us. And that's why I've kind of come to the realization over the years that just respect what somebody loves. I mean, hey, that's cool. If that's what they're into. I mean, dude, I don't know. I mean, Mexico, I have trust issues with Mexico right now and some of the monsters that are coming out of there, because I don't know which ones were, you know, have been all shot up with steroids, and that's, you know, you're not looking at the same thing. And then you look at something like that Gordon buck, the new world record non-typical that the guy shot in Southwest Colorado. I mean, holy crap, man, that buck is a freak, an absolute freak. And it's a genetic anomaly. I mean, say what you will about it, that buck is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a 348-inch deer. Dude, I'd love to shoot. I drew a good Utah elk tag this year. I'd love to see a 348-inch elk. I mean, much less a 348-inch mule deer. I mean, jeez. It's crazy, but...
And I mean, that thing was in velvet too when he shot it, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, you see like a 348-inch hardhorn, that's one thing. You see that in velvet, it looks twice as big, even. Like, it's just...
All the mass looks bigger, yeah. And it's just, you know, that's the kind of thing that keeps me up at night and keeps me going out scouting, you know, a lot during the summers, just the chance that I could stumble upon one, you know, one of those one in a million, once in a lifetime animals. And that's what keeps me coming back, man. I love it. Love the pursuit.
And that's what I mean, you know, I look back at my teeny little guy here, and he lives, you know, right here, right where every podcast I record, every video conference I'm on, every, you know, photo I take at my desk.
Yeah.
He's front and center along with my little raghorn elk now that's behind me. And I'll be, you know, I've said it a million times before, I'll be prouder of this deer and this elk than anything I will ever shoot in this lifetime. Like, I mean, I could shoot that Gordon buck, you know, this season for all I know. That, you know, something wild here in Montana could walk out on public land. I could get, let's face it, I could get lucky because it's not going to be through my spectacular huntsman hunter skills.
You figured out, you figured out how to kill them. And, you know, now it's a matter of taking that next step and taking some of the luck out of it by either putting in a lot of scouting, mm-hmm. and having, you know, hey, here's my number one buck, my number two buck, my number three buck or bull, whichever it is, you know. And then it's a matter of just finding coming up with a plan and executing the plan. And that's the cool thing is when, and that buck, that first buck will always mean the world to you. Dude, I've got a spike that I shot in Northern Arizona in 1989 on my first deer hunt that I had a tag for. I went out with my buddy, Kenny. He took me out. And I mean, we shot the only buck I saw that entire season. And to tell you just how big this spike was, it's in a quart Ziploc bag out on my workbench, the skull cap and the spike. But I mean, someday I'm going to do a picture of me, my wife, and my son, all with our first bucks. Both of which are shoulder mounted. Mine, I couldn't convince my mom to spring for a shoulder mount, you know. But and I don't know why. I mean, it was a huge buck, clearly. I mean, you know, those it's spikes were. Yeah, I mean, they were well over 4 inches. And I mean, 4 1/8 or something like that. But, you know, hey, I hunted my butt off for that thing. That was the only buck I saw. And when I saw it, I capitalized. And it meant meant the world to me, and it still does. And I love that.
I really do feel like, you know, I'm here in Montana. I really do feel like I should grab this and roll up to Missoula and take it into Boone and Crockett to get officially scored, just in case.
Oh, I think you should.
It's pretty enormous.
So here's the question that I always ask people is, how many mass measurements do you get on a spike? I mean, because that's I feel like that's the difference from a spike being, you know, like an 18-inch buck or like maybe a 30-inch buck. I mean, man, imagine that. But
This is
coming from a guy who has a few spike elk and is, you know, hanging out around the house here. So, never been able to figure out.
I'm going to have to give Boone and Crockett a call. I'm going to have to be like, hey guys, I need to talk to y'all. I need to talk to Pope and Young. We need to get this figured out. It's very, very critical for conservation purposes that we get this correct.
I agree.
We're very, very serious. Very, very serious topic.
If I were you, before you head over there, I'd probably ask for a panel measurement. Just so, you know, I mean, they do that for their, you know, like the top five, top 10 type bucks. Make sure, you know, you're getting an accurate representation.
Hey, I don't want my record in the books to be asterisked. So yeah, that's probably the best.
You want that sucker official. Absolutely.
I don't want it disputed, anything like that.
I love it, man.
Oh, man. Hey, who is allowing us to record this unsupervised, honestly?
No kidding. Like the poster children for adult onset ADD.
Oh, geez.
But yeah, I shot a little buck a few years ago. I'd had a job change, and I mean, the season was just a mess for me. And I literally had a few times out, and the last weekend out, man, this old Forky stepped out in front of me and I hesitated for about a third of a second. I made a great shot and put him down, and I kept telling, you know, everybody's like, why'd you shoot such a small buck? And I said, boy, that you're just looking at this all wrong. I said, as an archer, you know, I'm looking at that going, anybody can hit the big ones, but man, to hit a small one right in the lungs, do you know what kind of precision that takes? So, hey, just had a little fun with it. That's all.
You know, I'm just really trying to show off my archery skills. That's why.
Exactly.
You know, my first archery kill was a cottontail.
Yeah.
Actually, funny enough, it actually technically was my first archery kill was a cottontail.
So was mine.
Cottontail. My first
50 were probably cottontails and squirrels. So.
It was funny. I mean, it was out the trip I shot this deer. It was out with the guys, and we were going fishing. We were going to go fishing at this cattle pond, just take a break for the evening. We'd been hunting pretty hard for about a week. And we're like, let's just go like chill out. And we got a cooler full of beers and a thing of hot dogs. And we were jack pulling carp out of this cattle pond. And we pull up and my buddy's like, Sam, go shoot that rabbit. You'll get your first kill. I'm like, well, shit. All right. And pull out the judo tip.
Done.
And pull back. And I'm like, boom. And execute this perfect shot. And I just hear this weird noise of like a. And I'm like, what the hell was that? And I watch my arrow like go straight for a split second and then just veer off like in the most bizarre fashion. And I'm like, oh, that must have been one of my veins must have come full loose or something. and it didn't come off. I didn't lose it, but it was flapping. So it just made my arrow like go wah! Off to the side. Like, it, and my buddy looked at me like, what the hell was that? And so I'm like, you know what? Screw this. And I grabbed one of my broadheads and I was using, I think, Montech G5s at the time or something. So just a big old solid steel 3-blade broadhead. And, you know, the benefit of using those on something like a cottontail is you actually kill and gut the animal at the same time, simultaneously.
That can very much be true.
You know, again, just showing my knowledge of trick shots as an archer, I chose to save myself time by gutting the animal after dispatching it. So immediately after dispatching it that way. So you know, saving time, making sure that, you know, you're able to get the meat out quicker that way. It's really,
that's right. That's right. Well, and you don't have the guts in the animal spoiling any meat.
So. Exactly. It's, that's, you know, it's ethical. It's perfect. It's the perfect, perfect way to do it. Really. If you're, I mean, if you're not doing that on elk, you know, we just need bigger broadheads.
Well, and one other thing that it, in all seriousness, it shows you, hey, my broadheads are hitting where I'm aiming. Yep. And that's, I mean, that's a lesson that a lot of people go out to hunt and they don't have that lesson fully answered in their minds. They hope their broadheads are hitting where they're aiming, but most people don't do a full broadhead tune of their bow. And it, it always shocks me.
I feel like you go through these steps when you're, when you first start, you know, you're shooting your field tips and you, then you're like, okay, it's time to go hunting. You throw on your broadheads, maybe you make some small adjustments and then you go. Then the next year you're like, okay, I got to do this like broadhead tuning thing, but you don't really broadhead tune. You just, you shoot it and then you just adjust for your broadheads later. And you're like, okay, now I'm really dialed in with my broadheads. Then you finally get to that stage where you're like, okay, no, there's a correct way to do this. And my broadheads should be hitting in the same spot as my field tips. And you start like, and that's, I'm finally getting to the part where now I'm taking the time to really tune my bow, tune my arrows, and get into arguments with guys that shoot mechanicals about why tuning is actually necessary. that was a whole nother experience this last year.
Hey, I'll tell you, I've gone the full circle on broadheads. I started out shooting mechanicals. I shot a cheap mechanical that flew real well. Then I switched over to a fixed head and I had some good luck with that, but I just was always a little disappointed by the amount of blood on the ground. So I switched back to mechanicals. And I mean, I like blood trails that are so obvious that, you know, a visually impaired colorblind person could follow along and go, yep, here he goes right through here. That's what I'm looking for. So yeah, it's another one of those no right answer to it kind of questions, like, you know.
And I love shooting severs. Like I'm a huge fan of severs. Like I shoot the shit out of those things. And those are mechanical, but with my elk, like, I really like shooting those big old, and I mean, I'm shooting those single two blade, single bevels. And half of the time, those are nearly as, by the ones I get are nearly as wide as some of those severs when they open up. But
yeah,
those things are just, I mean, I got one right up there behind me, one of those kudu points, and those things are nasty. Those things, I will say the nice thing about the severs is you don't accidentally nick yourself when you're practicing. I've done that a few times.
Well, there is that. There is that. Yeah, I've kind of gone through and I've shot Swackers. I've shot, you know, Grim Reapers, and I've just ended up back with the Grim Reapers.
Yeah.
I like three blades because I like three surfaces cutting versus two. And I just feel like your odds of catching a, you know, of clipping an artery or a vein are just that much higher when you've got that extra blade in there. So yeah,
well, that's the thing. Like you can, like everyone has their, what they prefer with their style of shooting and what they like to hunt. And you can sit and debate all of the intricacies of it.
Oh yeah.
Every single day of your life. And you could change, you could have a different style of broadhead for every animal you hunt based on that and this and that and the other. And it just comes down to like, what's your focus and, you know, what's your setup? What's your focus? What do you like to shoot? Cause no answer is going to be right for everyone. And we're all trying to find a broadhead that's going to work for the majority of what we like to hunt. You know, okay, maybe you're going out for turkey. You'll probably pick something a little different than what you're shooting for elk, or you may just grab your bow and hammer a turkey with a 605 grain arrow. But
they're going to be just as dead.
I once had a buddy, I was hunting with a buddy. We were doing an elk hunt. We were chasing grouse and we, you know, we each had a couple of judo tips, but we were back there for like 7 days And so we had, you know, we lost one and we had busted the other, this or that. And so we were kind of just down to our broadhead arrows. And finally, like we'd had a bunch of grouse, and there's this one grouse, both of us lost the judo tip on it. And for some reason, like, we could not hit this thing, but then it was just insult to injury at that point. And my buddy was like, screw it, pulled out one of his broadheads. And oh, cause what it was is I missed him. He clipped him, but the thing like flew away, or he like clipped him pretty well with the judo tip, and yeah, it flew away. And he's like, screw this, pulled out the broadhead, and the thing landed right in front of a log. And 20 yards, he hammers this grouse with a full, like, again, like solid steel broadhead, pins it to the log. And he's like, and I just remember hearing him say, fly away now, asshole. Went up and, right, like, and we had grouse and Mountain House chicken and rice for dinner that day. And it was lovely.
There you go. There you go. Some good fresh protein.
There we go.
Grouse are made for stuff like that. They're made for stories like that too, because mm-hmm. I mean, you find me a hunter who hasn't hit a grouse and had it fly away, and I'll show you a hunter who probably hasn't shot a grouse. I mean, that's just the way they go. I mean, they're a frustrating little animal like that.
Oh man. But well, man, on that note, I always like to kind of wind down with, like, say, you know, somebody comes up to you, you know, you run into someone, they find out you're a hunter, and they're like, hey man, you know, like, I see you got all these mule deer mounts. These things are awesome. But like, I've always wanted to get into hunting, but I don't know. There's so much to learn. I don't have any friends that do it. I don't know anyone that does it. Like, I don't know if it's for me. What kind of words of encouragement would you give that person as far as like getting into the outdoors, getting into hunting?
That's easy. It's for everybody. I mean, and I say that because as humans, we are innately hunters and gatherers. That's what we've been for, you know, our previous generations. That's how they live. That's how they sustain themselves. And I feel like that's in each of us to some extent. And a lot of us, it lies very deep. It lies very, very deep. But I do feel like even if, and I've taken people out who have zero interest in hunting, zero interest, but I've taken them out with me. They're like, hey, I just want to see what the attraction is. I'm like, hey, come out for a scouting trip with me. And, you know, I'll pick you up at your house at 3:00. And we'll, they're like, PM, like, oh, heck no, AM. And we'll go out and we'll drive for a few hours. We'll hike for a little bit and we'll be in place when the sun comes up. And I mean, you know, most people won't take you up on it. 3:00 is a barrier to entry that keeps most people out. But I've had a couple friends take me up on it. And when they go out, they see the outdoors through a different lens. And I mean, I've had a couple of them, you know, a couple of good memories from that. We had, we actually took the bishop from our church out with us once, and he just, you know, he still doesn't hunt, but he appreciated it. He grew to appreciate where that jerky that I gave him every year came from, and saw the outdoors through a different lens, rather than just saying, hey, see those deer over there on that hill. We sat there and watched those deer for a couple hours and broke down what they were doing, why they were doing it. And, you know, hey, and then I asked him, all right, it's opening day. You've got a tag. You need to get within 50 yards of that buck. How do you do it from here? And, you know, you kind of go through the step-by-step of a stock, and it just opened his eyes. And he's like, man, this is really cool. He goes, it's not for me, but it's really cool. And that's, yeah. And you know, I respect that, but I think that's the best way to do it, is just get somebody out there, get somebody outdoors with you, and let them see animals through a different lens, so to speak.
Awesome, man. Well, I really appreciate you sitting down, taking the time. I know you're heading out first thing tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad we were able to make this work, man.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com/205 and get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. Big thank you to Henry for taking the time out, hopping on. Really had a good time chatting with him. Definitely have to let y'all know what my little teeny spike scores when I get the Boone and Crockett or the Pope and Young panels to give it an official score. But, you know, on that note, y'all, that'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this episode inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. And head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from The Wild Initiative family, and more.